Topic number two. This year of 1982 has started out with bad news on the economic front. Inflation is said to have slackened off slightly, but as every householder knows, it has not gone away by any means. Only a short decade ago, President Nixon declared a national emergency when official inflation rates reached only 7 to 8%. If anyone had told you then that 10% inflation was on the way, you probably would not have believed it. Yet today we are supposed to be relieved when inflation drops to that level. As bad as inflation is, another worry is pushing it into the background in the minds of millions of Americans. The number one worry now is that of losing one's job, and no wonder. Early this month, it was announced that unemployment, as officially calculated, reached 8.9% in December. Among blue-collar workers who actually produce the nation's goods, it is even worse. More than one out of eight is out of work. Unemployment is worst of all in the auto industry. Officially, nearly 22% of all auto workers ended December without a job. The auto industry, my friends, is not just in a recession, it's in a depression. The same is true of housing and construction. And as I detailed in Audio Letter 69, these two sectors are the keys to throwing America's entire economy into a depression. We are descending deeper and deeper into the mire of economic stagflation, that is, high inflation with high unemployment. There's nothing accidental about it, my friends. It's being orchestrated by powerful forces who are bent on seizing more power, and the plans were laid long ago. That's why I was able to give details in advance about our present woes 8 years ago in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar. For example, American business today is being strangled by a credit crunch, the so-called tight money policy of the privately owned Federal Reserve Corporation. The tight money and high interest rates, we are told, are the bitter medicine we must take in order to cure inflation. As a result, small and medium-sized industries which welcomed inflation just a few short years ago are now in distress because of it. The situation now is the one I tried to warn against 8 years ago. On page 83 of my book, I expressed it this way, and I quote, "In the early stages of stagflation, those industries in debt are able to pay off their indebtedness with cheap dollars. But in the later stages, these same industries are apt to experience a scarcity of capital." Unquote. The White House and Capitol Hill are well aware that millions of us are hurting badly from the worsening economic conditions. And so, to make political hay, they are all pointing fingers at one another and proclaiming themselves to be our champions. Meanwhile, what have they done concretely to deal with the situation? Why, of course, they are helping themselves. Only a few days ago, the Internal Revenue Service announced a tremendous new windfall tax break for members of Congress. The new rules, which were ordered by Congress, virtually exempt congressmen and senators from paying any federal income tax. While the rest of us struggle to make ends meet, Congress has once again made sure that its members do not share our plight. Workers who have given up big chunks of their pay lately in order to save their companies must still pay up to Uncle Sam. But not your senator or congressman. I suggest you remember that the next time you see any member of Congress crying crocodile tears about your economic woes. And what about the Federal Reserve Board, which is responsible for setting the high interest rates that are choking our economy? Might the nation's private central banking system relent a bit in view of the frightening upsurge in unemployment? Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker answered that earlier this week in a speech in Las Vegas. Speaking to a convention of home builders, Volcker said, in effect, that the interest rate crunch is doing what it is supposed to do. Therefore, said Volcker, the Federal Reserve has no intention of lowering interest rates and loosening up money. But then, why should anyone expect anything else from Paul Volcker? As I detailed in my book 8 years ago, Volcker was one of the prime architects of the long-range plan to ruin the dollar. And I revealed more about Volcker's role about the coming depression and war in my very first talking tape in 1974. In that tape, I mentioned Volcker's role as one of the prime conspirators who helped spirit away America's gold. On all sides, my friends, there is corruption, double-dealing, lies, conflicts of interest, and criminality in high places. Last month I reported that a new phase of the gold scandal is underway. It involves the movement of gold from the New York Assay Office to the insecure West Point Depository. The so-called Reagan administration is preparing to close down the New York Assay Office and is giving excuses for it that make no sense whatsoever. One such excuse is to improve security, but the security at West Point is even worse than that of the New York Assay Office. Another excuse for moving the gold is said to be to save money, but hundreds of thousands of dollars are being squandered at West Point because of the gold transfer. The only real result of the gold transfer will be to make it easier to steal. As I reported last month, one of the principals involved in implementing the plan to shut down the Assay Office was Dr. Alan Goldman. Goldman has been with the Bureau of the Mint since 1970 and has been its deputy director for some time. The director, Donna Pope, is a political appointee with little more than figurehead status. Therefore, it's Goldman who has really been running the Bureau of the Mint. That is, until a few weeks ago. There has been a very odd new development. Having helped to set the events in motion for a shutdown of the New York Assay Office, Goldman resigned from his top job at the Mint on December 22. Reportedly, he has accepted a position in private industry. So, what's odd about that? Just this. The New York Assay Office is the only government-owned facility for refining precious metals in the country. After it is shut down, the Reagan administration plan is to contract out the refining of gold and other precious metals to a private industrial concern. It will be a bonanza for whoever receives the government refining contract. And Dr. Goldman, who just left the Mint for private industry, just happens to be an expert in precious metals refining. The strange circumstances surrounding the plan to close down the New York Assay Office are raising many questions, and those questions multiply in light of major concerns over the shutdown plan from another source. That source, my friends, is the United States Navy. Up to now, the Assay Office has played a critical role in the Navy's Silver Reclamation Program. The Navy has an ongoing requirement for silver reclamation from many tons of materials each year. These materials include worn-out batteries, photographic supplies, and many components of classified systems. The Navy sends these things to the Assay Office in New York, which extracts the silver and returns it to the Navy. In addition, the Silver Reclamation Program of the Navy generates large amounts of precious metals byproducts. These byproducts include not only gold, but rare metals like platinum and iridium, which are much more valuable than gold. The New York Assay Office does not return these precious metals byproducts to the Navy. Instead, they're returned to the government's strategic stockpile of critical materials or to the Treasury. Either way, these precious byproducts remain in government hands. The plan to close down the Assay Office has the Navy up in arms. Transferring the silver reclamation program into the hands of private industry will mean that the government will lose control of those precious metals byproducts. The Navy is convinced that the refining contractor will be in a position to pocket large amounts of the byproducts. It will be a tremendous windfall profit for the refining contractor and could even compromise national security. The so-called Reagan administration claims to consider national security its top priority, yet proposes to damage it by the New York Assay Office shutdown. Yes, a precious metals byproducts profit windfall awaits the private refining contractor. And my friends, Dr. Alan Goldman, who has just joined private industry, was the United States Mint's top specialist in the area of extracting precious metals byproducts. Besides the Goldman affair, other developments are raising still more questions about the sudden movement of gold to the isolated West Point depository. One of these developments is the change which is taking place in the recommendation expected soon from the United States Gold Commission. In AUDIO LETTER 67, I detailed the plan which then existed for the Gold Commission to propose a new pseudo-gold standard for America. But in recent weeks, that plan has been changed. Instead, the administration wants the Commission to recommend only that a new gold coin be minted for its psychological value. The earlier pseudo-gold standard plan would have required that some gold be on hand. But now the United States government suddenly needs to be free to sell gold secretly through intermediaries on the free market. The reason is a stunning economic coup by Russia. United States intelligence operatives first picked up hints that something big was in the works early last fall. As the information developed, the decision was made to move the New York Assay Office gold to West Point. And earlier this month, on January 11, the dreaded Russian economic coup began to take place. What took place that day was a secret financial transaction in Geneva, Switzerland, the first of many which cannot be reversed. A deal was struck which will progressively give the Russian government a decisive economic edge over the United States. It will give the Soviet Union devastating leverage over the United States Treasury Department in particular, and thus over the economic fate of this country in general. When the series of transactions which began this month have been completed, it will give the Kremlin effective control over America's economic structure. The Russians will be in a position to use this unique power in any way they choose. They can use it to disrupt the economic maneuvers of the great and powerful forces here if desired. They can also use it to destroy the investments and assets of every person having a bank account or fund denominated in dollars. Or they can threaten America's rulers with economic blackmail if America's secret war preparations are not stopped. Once the transactions now underway are completed, those capabilities will be in Russia's hands. The transaction of January 11 was a huge gold sale by Russia to certain other interests. First, Russia had placed billions of dollars worth of gold in escrow under control of three Geneva banks. Then the buyers of the gold paid for it in billions of dollars worth of United States Treasury securities. That is, title to these Treasury instruments of liability was transferred to the Soviet Union. The sale is to be only the first of many because the gold buyers control vast quantities of Treasury securities, that is, billions of dollars worth of Treasury bills, notes, and bonds. These securities bear interest and mature at specified dates. At the maturity date, the holder has the right to turn them in and receive full payment of the principal from the Treasury Department, but usually that does not happen. Most big holders of Treasury securities roll them over at the maturity date. That is, the holder exchanges the old note or bond for a new one and continues collecting interest. But now, billions upon billions of dollars worth of these United States Treasury securities are beginning to move into the hands of the Russian government. and once they hold a large enough hoard of these Treasury instruments, the Russians can choose not to roll them over. They can present them to the Treasury Department and say, "Pay up." Intelligence circles here in the United States were notified immediately after consummation of the first deal on January 11. In response, certain government officials here are trying to undo the agreement by attempting to reduce the market price of gold. To that end, gold from what little is left of America's decimated stockpile is being secretly sold on the open market through devious channels. But so far, this tactic has had little effect on the gold markets. In any case, my friends, the agreement has been struck between Russia and certain Persian Gulf Arabs, and both parties have already resolved that they will follow through even if the market price of gold drops to zero, because this financial transaction is a rare one in the history of the world. It is based primarily on moral grounds. Both parties believe that the United States has become hopelessly degenerate. In their eyes, America is Babylon, and until Babylon falls, the world will never know peace. As I say these words, the clammy atmosphere of panicky fear is taking hold in certain financial circles here. The sum total of all outstanding Treasury obligations, that is, the national debt, now stands at $1 trillion. The Soviet Union has now begun acquiring control of a portion of that debt. Top Treasury officials are beginning to see the specter of calamity looming ahead. Someday Russia may, in effect, walk into the United States Treasury as if it were a bank and withdraw her deposits. The strain thus produced could induce other large holders of Treasury securities to do the same out of fear of weakness in the Treasury's position. It could all snowball into the great granddaddy of all bank runs, an international run on the Treasury of the United States. The Treasury could not possibly pay off the $1 trillion national debt, and so the Treasury would collapse, and with it would go the entire economy of the United States, and finally, of the entire Western world. Topic number 3. 3 days ago, on January 26, the entity President Reagan gave his first State of the Union speech. That same day, an all-day meeting took place in Geneva, Switzerland, between the two top diplomats of America and Russia, Secretary of State Alexander Haig and Russia's Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko met far longer than expected that day, nearly 8 hours in all. The reasons given publicly for the meeting were intentionally vague. Supposedly, there was no particular agenda for the meeting, nothing specific to negotiate, no clear-cut goals to be accomplished. In fact, the main comments the two sides made to reporters beforehand were about what they intended not to discuss. Haig said he would not talk about any resumption of the SALT talks. Gromyko said he would not talk about Poland. And at the end of the day, even the single announced outcome of the discussions was negative. We were told that any effort to set up an East-West summit between Reagan and Brezhnev was being put on a back burner. That's how the meeting between Haig and Gromyko looked on the surface, but behind closed doors, what went on that day was far different. The meeting took place only 15 days after Russia concluded her momentous secret financial transaction, and it was symbolic that both Russia's financial coup and the Haig-Gromyko meeting took place in the same city, Geneva. The meeting of Haig and Gromyko reflects a startling new turning point in international relations. To understand what happened, it is essential to realize that the struggle for world power today is more complex than it appears on the surface. Daily news reports make it appear that it is basically a struggle between two antagonists, the United States and Russia. Everyone else gets classified as an American ally, or as a Russian satellite, or as part of the non-aligned Third World, so-called. That concept is simple and easy for just about everyone to understand. It's the old us versus them idea. Unfortunately, it happens to be wrong. The fact is that today the struggle for world power is not two-sided, but three-sided. There are three great power factions at work in the world today, each one jostling and maneuvering against the other two. I've devoted many past reports to giving you details about these three power factions and their relationships to one another, but let me just remind you once again who they are. Power faction number one is the Rockefeller Cartel, which embraces big oil, big banking, and large chunks of big business. Until about 3 years ago, the Rockefeller Cartel reigned supreme here in the United States. American government policies were Rockefeller policies, and American wars were Rockefeller wars. Power faction number two is the International Bolshevik and Zionist Axes. As I detailed in AUDIO LETTERS 49 and 50, Bolshevism and Zionism are closely related and owe their existence partly to Rockefeller help long ago. After Bolshevism was imposed on Russia in 1917, a secret alliance was forged between the Bolsheviks in Russia and the Rockefeller Cartel here. For 6 decades, these two factions orchestrated the actions of the Soviet Union and the United States for mutual benefit. By pretending to be enemies, they established a giant pincers movement that was gobbling up the world. But power faction number three has completely changed that picture during the past few years. This third faction is the tightly knit band of native Russians who have overthrown the Bolsheviks at the top in Russia. Russia's new rulers are a tough sect of Christians who are working from the top down to gradually weed out all the Bolsheviks in Russia. It's a Herculean task, but they are more patient than we in the West. They worked for 6 decades to seize control of the Kremlin, and they know better than to become hasty or impatient now. During recent years, the new Kremlin has been expelling the hated Bolsheviks from Russia. Here in America, the Rockefellers made the fatal mistake of welcoming the Bolsheviks from Russia. The Bolsheviks can never share power with anyone, and some 3 years ago, they launched a coup d'etat against the Rockefellers. The coup began with the murder of Nelson Rockefeller, which was quickly disguised and covered up. Then Russian intelligence intervened here in Washington to prevent the Bolsheviks from achieving total success. Since that time, there have been these three factions struggling for power. Here in America, the Rockefeller Cartel is fighting a guerrilla war against the Bolsheviks for control over our country. The Bolsheviks, with their Zionist partners in Israel, are feverishly trying to get America into a nuclear war against Russia. And in Russia, the secret new rulers are continuing to root out Bolshevism. And as they do so, Christianity is beginning to revive in Russia. It's a long process, but it's happening. At the same time, the Kremlin is preparing for what they regard as the inevitable war, even as they try to prevent it. So these are the three power factions now at work. Here in America, the Bolsheviks, transplanted here after their expulsion from Russia, bent on war against Russia. Also here in America, the Rockefeller Cartel, who no longer want war for the reasons I detailed in AUDIO LETTER 67. They are preoccupied with regaining control over America. And the third faction, Russia's new rulers, do not want war for moral reasons. My friends, the meeting of Haig and Gromyko this week was actually a tough bargaining session between the Russians and the Rockefeller faction here. For entirely different reasons, they presently find themselves with some interests in common. Both are now deadly enemies of the Bolsheviks here, the Rockefellers on a domestic basis, the Russians on an international basis. And for totally different reasons, both the Rockefeller Cartel and the Russians want to prevent the war which the Bolsheviks are trying to set off. During recent months, secret meetings have taken place between the representatives of the Rockefeller cartel and Russia's ruling group. Those meetings led up to the Hay-Gromyko meeting this week. My friends, a quid pro quo is now in the works between the Russians and the Rockefeller cartel. It will be aimed at their mutual enemy, the Bolsheviks. Meanwhile, the Bolsheviks here are continuing to line up support for the big war they intend to ignite soon. At the same time, the Russians are equally busy trying to dissuade other countries from getting involved. These cross currents are producing some surprising lineups for war. Here is how it stands as of now, but keep in mind that further changes are bound to happen. On the side of the United States, Red China is the Bolsheviks' greatest prize up to now. Due to sheer numbers, Red China can tie down 50 Russian divisions. Chinese geography is also crucial, especially Sinkiang Province, for American bases to attack Russia. Other major allies as of now are Great Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. New Zealand, by the way, is far more important than one might expect. The Bolsheviks here are also lining up the North countries, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden. Of these, Norway is both the most important and most deeply committed to the war plan. The United States can also count on certain Latin American countries, and now also English-speaking Canada. This last represents a major change over the past 3 years. On Russia's side, the Warsaw Pact is still solid except Poland. Vietnam and North Korea also remain under Russia's control, as does Cuba. In addition, Russia can expect crucial help from India, Mexico, and French-speaking Quebec Province, Canada. Where Russia has made the most dramatic progress is in convincing nominal allies of the United States to turn neutral at the secret level. Countries in this category include Japan, France, Spain, the Netherlands, and even Belgium, where NATO headquarters is located. But the biggest target of all in this neutral category is West Germany. The Russians are holding out a firm promise to bond if the West Germans will simply set out any war to come. The promise, my friends, is the reunification of Germany. That promise was the secret reason behind the recent historic meeting of the leaders of the two Germanys, Schmidt and Honecker. Yes, my friends, the alliances are shifting as we draw closer to nuclear war one. Some of these alliances are beginning to work against the Bolsheviks here. But as the Bolsheviks see the tide beginning to turn against them, they are only redoubling their frenzy for war. As a result, this new year of 1982 will be dangerous, and it may well also be decisive for the future of the world. Now it is time for my last-minute summary. As you know, last month in Audio Letter 70, I offered to make a major change in the format of my intelligence report program. The revised arrangement would have involved less frequent tape reports, with a new printed newsletter every 2 weeks. Since my only purpose in making such a change would be to serve you better, I asked for your reactions to the plan. Based on the response to Audio Letter 70, my friends, my decision is not to proceed with the new printed newsletter idea. Instead, what I do plan to do is to resume making a tape every month, as I did before my heart attack 2 years ago. I want to thank all of you who responded with your reactions as I requested last month. I know a few of you will be disappointed with the way it turned out, but I will do my very best to serve you even better than in the past. After all, serving you is what the audio letter is all about. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.